It's Tuesday, October 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a major earthquake shakes Afghanistan. European leaders move toward a plan to deal with migrants and refugees.
North Korea chooses when and how the family reunions happen.
A second group of Korean families briefly reunite. Also ahead, country legend Hank Williams returns, in the movies that is. It's all on today's International Edition. A major earthquake struck a remote area of northern Afghanistan on Monday, killing nearly 300 people there and in neighboring Pakistan, injuring more than 1,700. A quake registered at a magnitude of 7.5, according to the U.S. Geological Survey, and it was centered deep beneath the Hindu Kush Mountains in a sparsely populated Afghan province that borders Pakistan, Tajikistan, and China. Reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad describes the event to International Edition host Susan Yaki.
Well, it seems that there has been extensive damage, particularly in northwestern Pakistan. I mean, the area which borders Afghanistan, and we know that the epicenter of the earthquake was located in Afghanistan. So the northwestern mountainous region of Pakistan suffered the most. You know, it's mainly in this part of Pakistan. It's not very well developed area, and mostly it's mud houses, and the structures, especially residential structures, are not that strong enough to sustain this kind of a shock. I mean, the way the earthquake shook entire Pakistan, we could imagine that there must have been a lot of damage. But because it's nighttime and the earthquake happened in the late afternoon, so obviously it will take some time before the authorities come up with some real assessment of exactly what kind of damage that has occurred in that area. And we have been told that maybe by Tuesday morning, the military missions that have been dispatched to the area to assess the damage will be able to provide some initial reports.
Tell us about your personal experience.
Well, it was really a very strong tremor. You know, as soon as it hit, I mean, it was a terrible. I was sitting on the first floor of my house with my kids, and we all had to just flee the home. We were just thinking maybe it's going to come down on us. And we just went outside in the street where hundreds of people had already gathered. At the, you know, the way this thing started, we didn't feel initially, but we realized once we were on the street that people were already afraid of it and scared. And they were all gathered there and we were with them. But we could see then, you know, the way the windows were shaking and our houses, the entire houses, you know, back and forth, they were swinging here and there. I mean, it was quite an amazing scene to have experienced, because it continued. The earthquake persisted for about a minute, and it was quite intense. And it was really, I mean, we were scared, and it took us a while before we came back to our homes, because everybody was scared. Maybe it will come back again. So it was quite a terrible experience that not only we personally experienced, but all over Pakistan, especially those areas which were hit by the earthquake. And it reminded us of the kind of experience we have had in 2005 on October 8th in that year. And that was also the epicenter of that earthquake was not far from Islamabad. And it shook us at that time. But today, because the duration was so long, that it really scared everybody.
Reporter Ayaz Ghul. The massive earthquake also triggered landslides in mountainous northern and northwestern Pakistan. The army says rubble has blocked the road in five places along the only link between Pakistan and China. An aerial assessment of that damage in the quake zone may not be available until later today. The USGS also registered two tremors with magnitudes of 4.7 and 4.8 in that same region within 90 minutes of the major quake. Reports say buildings also swayed in the Indian capital, New Delhi, forcing office workers out into the streets. The earthquake comes nearly 6 months after a devastating quake in Nepal that killed thousands of people and destroyed hundreds of thousands of homes. Well, we turn to our social media segment. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here in Studio 22 to bring us the latest buzz online. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
What's trending on Twitter today?
Many media outlets are still tweeting about the earthquake that hit Pakistan, India, and Afghanistan, as you told us. The Economist at The Economist on Twitter sent out this tweet. From Instagram, rubble after an earthquake in Mingora, Swat, Pakistan, October 26, 2015. That tweet quickly got more than 50 shares within 30 minutes of posting.
And it's from Instagram, so it's got to be either a still photo or a short clip, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. So on Instagram, The Economist shared a photo of residents in Pakistan walking past a damaged house from the earthquake with the hashtags earthquake, shockwaves, and Pakistan. More than 1,300 people liked that photo. Jim, and I want to mention that this trend of a social media account of a particular company sharing information from the same company's another social media platform will only get more popular going forward.
Well, I definitely see that more often these days. What about from the government side? Tell us about some of the tweets from Washington.
Sure. The State Department at State DPT on Twitter shared a video clip of spokesman John Kirby at Daily Briefing. In the clip, Kirby said, "We'd like to express our deepest condolences to all those who are affected by the magnitude 7.5 earthquake." VOA's White House correspondent Arul Pandey also tweeted, "White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said, the U.S. stands ready to provide support to Afghan and Pakistani governments. Deepest condolences to those affected."
I see. So how many are affected by the earthquake?
Well, there are no official figures as of yet, but the digital media website Mashable tweeted, "The death toll is up to 260 now and expected to rise." Back to you.
Thank you so much for that update, G. That was our social media guru, G. Abby Lee. You can follow her on Twitter anytime you like at her personal account, G. Abby Lee. Of course, the at sign in front. Also following our program's account at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
This is VOA's International Edition. European leaders meeting in Brussels have pledged to cooperate to control the flow of tens of thousands of migrants and refugees flooding the continent from South Asia, the Middle East, and Africa, even as cold weather begins to settle in over Europe's worst post-war humanitarian crisis. They are expanding reception capacities and border controls while improving the registration and screening process for those who do survive the journey. Jean-Claude Juncker is the president of the European Commission, and he's followed by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres.
We will increase reception capacities to 100,000 places in Greece and in the Western Balkans. To safeguard Schengen, we also need to strengthen border management between Greece, the former ex-Yugoslavic Republic of Macedonia, Albania, and Serbia. In addition, we will deploy 400 police officers to Slovenia within a week.
I do believe that the decisions that were in consensus among those present in this meeting will give an important contribution to allow for the right bodies of the European Union to take the decisions that are needed to make sure that this situation that we always considered it it was manageable will become effectively managed. First of all, to the benefit of the people in need, but also to guarantee the union and the stability of the European institutions.
Slovenia has had to cope with tens of thousands of people who have arrived in the tiny Alpine country in just the last 10 days. Davy Sims is a former BBC journalist who spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty from the resort village of Bled.
It will not stem the flow, not immediately, and certainly not within the next few weeks. But I think the important thing, or there are several important things that have come from this crisis meeting, and I think the most important thing is, first of all, the assistance that is going to be shown to the Balkan region, and also the improvement in communication. There has been very poor communication between some of the countries. And where I'm speaking from, Slovenia, and the next-door neighbor, Croatia, there have been an exchange of very harsh words over the past 7 to 10 days. I have also already noted this morning that there has been a note in one of the news agencies, the Slovenian news agency, that already communication has improved between the two countries, and the police in Croatia are alerting the police in Slovenia as to where they will be delivering the refugees and the migrants.
Slovenia's Prime Minister Miro Cerar warned that the EU itself is at stake as he arrived for those talks. Quote, if we don't deliver some immediate and concrete actions on the ground in the next few days and weeks, I believe the EU and Europe as a whole will start falling apart, unquote.
It sounds as if it's an exaggeration. You could counter it by saying the European Union has a much longer view than one immediate crisis. And there are several crises facing the European Union. But I think that Cerar is saying something that is important for his own electorate to hear. Angela Merkel, the premier from Germany, did not quite disagree and said this is one of the litmus tests that Europe is facing at the moment. So this is an important litmus test, or Europe falling apart. I think Merkel probably has the correct emphasis, but Cerar is very concerned. This is a very small country. Last night, since he spoke, 15,000 more refugees have arrived in the country. I think his electorate, his people here, need to hear strong, not harsh, but strong words as he goes into a negotiation.
Well, this meeting also produced a promise of some 400 border guards to Slovenia. Is that going to help them control the situation?
Certainly, I think it's already been welcomed by the Slovenian news agencies. 400 border guards, 400 police coming in to help will certainly will help improve things. The information that we get, Victor, at the moment is the number of people who are arriving. What we're not quite clear on is the number of people who are leaving, because this is a transit area. The migrants and the refugees do not want to stay in Slovenia. They're bound for other places. Slovenia is a poor country. It has relatively high unemployment. It has difficulty in managing the refugees. And while I'm talking about 15,000 arriving overnight, or expected, estimated, there are other estimates, around 100,000 in the past 9 days, says one report, and 60,000 in the past 6 days, says another report. But we don't know how quickly they are leaving the country. They're being processed, certainly. They're not staying here. The border guards will help to get people through the country from where they are coming from, which is the southern Balkans, through Croatia, then on through Slovenia and into Austria.
Davy Sims adds temperatures are falling in the region, but that hasn't diminished the numbers of those fleeing poverty, persecution, and war. He says those who left in early summer embark on a journey that takes months and are only just now arriving at the beginning of the winter season. A second short and emotional reunion of family members separated by the Korean War ended at the North Korean resort of Mount Kumgang. Some family members had not seen each other in more than 60 years. Family reunions are the first since February of 2014 and are the result of an agreement between the Koreas reached last August on diffusing tensions. Korea analyst Malcolm Cook, a senior fellow at the Singapore-based Institute for Southeast Asian Studies, notes Pyongyang is in full control when those reunions occur.
North Korea chooses when and how the family reunions happen, and I think the North Korean regime, including under Kim Jong-un, see it as a kind of olive branch. So they, things like missile launches and threats of military actions against the South are counterbalanced over time with these offers of either summits between the two leaders or family reunions. So it's part of the overall management of by North Korea of the inter-Korean relationship.
The reunion is considered a rare event.
Yeah, it's certainly, I think it's only the second or third time in there. It's the first time in quite a while when Lee Moon-byak was in power, the previous president, the North Korean regime under Kim Jong-il, refused to have any of those types of meeting, largely because they didn't see any interest in offering, as I say, olive branch or positive incentives. Park Geun-hye, the new president or present president in South Korea, has taken a softer or more moderate approach to relations with the North, and I think these family reunions are a sign of recognition of that in the North.
Korea analyst Malcolm Cook, he's a senior fellow at the Singapore-based Institute for Southeast Asian Studies. Be sure to stop by our website. It's voanews.com to read more about the Korean reunion story. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Well, there's certainly no shortage of new movies for you to choose from to watch. There's now a new film that explores the life of country music star Hank Williams. Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to discuss I Saw the Light.
Well, if you enjoy musical biopics like Ray or Get On Up or even Walk the Line, you're in for another treat. Some of you may remember the Johnny Cash biopic, I Walk the Line. Well, another country music icon story is coming to the big screen. I Saw the Light tells the story of country legend Hank Williams. Written and directed by Mark Abraham, the film chronicles Williams' meteoric rise to fame and its ultimately tragic effect on his health and personal life. The movie premiered in Nashville this past weekend. Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here to talk about it. Nikki, tell us about Hank Williams.
Wow, Hank is awesome. Now, even though he's categorized as a country music artist, he is considered one of the most influential singer-songwriters in American music history. I mean, Bob Dylan cites him as a major influence. I was introduced to a lot of Hank's music through Elvis Presley. He is one of country music's first superstars, one of the first to be inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. He was born from humble beginnings. He had spina bifida, which separated him from his peers growing up, and he found solace in music. And he was strongly influenced by what was playing on the radio, as well as church choirs, and he learned how to play guitar from an African-American street performer named Rufus Payne, which largely informed his musical style. And along with Roy Acuff and Ernest Tubb, he went on to work for a radio station, formed a band, pursued his career, continued to write multiple hits such as Hey Good Lookin', we know that one, I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, Your Cheatin' Heart, and went on to win various honors. The film is based on the book Hank Williams, The Biography by Colin Escott. The director and screenwriter, Mark Abraham, focuses on the period between 1944 to 1953. So that's when Hank was 21, married his first wife, Audrey, until his death at only 29 years old due to excessive alcohol and drug abuse.
How has the film been received so far?
Okay, well, this is not the first biopic on Hank Williams, yeah. So there's a lot out there. Reviews are mixed. There's a lot of focus on his personal life and marital problems, when some wanted more of a better understanding of what made Hank's music resonate so strongly during that time in history, and what it was about his work and his artistry that made him a superstar. However, one thing that has been getting great reviews consistently is Tom Hiddleston as Hank Williams. They say he may win an Oscar for his performance. That's how strong it is.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, the film won't be an Oscar contender this year, though, because its release was pushed back.
Yeah, it was supposed to be released in November, so it was supposed to be released next month. But they decided to push the movie back because it's a crowded award season, and Sony didn't want it to get lost in the shuffle. And the lead, Tom Hiddleston, the actor, was unavailable for promotional duties because he's busy shooting another movie and he just finished a television show.
When will it be released?
Okay, it's going to be out March 25th of next year.
You can catch up with Nikki Strong on Country Hits USA on VOA 1. You can reach her on Twitter at VOA underscore music or on Facebook at VOA Music. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you.
Your cheating heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and cry.
You've been listening to International Edition. You know, there are a lot of great ways you can get our program. One super way to do that is to stop by our website, voanews.com, anytime that you like. You can follow us, too, on your mobile device or computer through Twitter. Our handle, at VOA underscore IE. Our program can't go out without a great director and engineer. We thank Tracy Carter and Zeynep Abdel-Rahman for your wonderful work today. And we thank you for joining us. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a super day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Terrorist groups need a steady influx of money in order to pursue their deadly agendas. ISIL or Daesh is no exception. Indeed, one of the ways Daesh leaders bring in significant revenue for their personal gain is through high taxes on conquered populations. Daesh levies taxes on goods and commerce that enter and transit areas they control. According to a report by the Financial Action Task Force on Money Laundering, this includes a road tax of $200 in northern Iraq and $800 customs tax on trucks entering Iraq along the Syrian and Jordanian borders. Furthermore, the U.S. government estimates that ISIL generates hundreds of millions of dollars per year by extorting the local population and all commercial activity taking place in the territory it controls. These exorbitant taxes imposed by Daesh are unlawful. The tax revenues collected do not provide people living under Daesh's rule with basic services or health care, but instead impede their access to doctors, medicine, and treatment. The Iraqi parliament tasked a committee to investigate Daesh's tax system. It found that Daesh has earned roughly $11 million monthly from taxes imposed on the residents of Nineveh province. Residents of Mosul who use electric generators have paid Daesh a $200 fee each to use them. And Daesh has taxed wholesale fruits and vegetables, earning about $200,000 monthly. Daesh also taxes oil and cement trucks and goods transported. Oil and gas is sold to local customers, smugglers, and to the Assad regime, generating hundreds of millions of dollars per year for ISIL. Daesh has imposed taxes on farmers in Tahmis and Al-Hasaka, Syria. The terrorist group lies and tells farmers that the taxes it collects are for zakat, the Islamic almsgiving. Daesh has also fined farmers for collusion with Daesh's enemies. Daesh defectors corroborate the terrorist organization's corrupt practices. Saddam al-Jamal, a former emir and Daesh defector, said, "What moves Daesh's emirs are their love for money and their seeking of power, not religion." Undercutting Daesh's financial strength remains a key element of the United States' strategy to ultimately degrade and defeat ISIL. That is why we are working with a coalition of 65 countries in a multifaceted effort to counter ISIL.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.